Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of the Cure Panel Talk Show on Myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Panel, joining you from India. And I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. This is Cure Panel's 65th episode, and on our myeloma broadcast today, we are discussing myeloma relapse. My co-host for the show today is myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. On the panel are Cure panelists Pat Killingsworth, Jack Aiello, Nick Van Dyke, and Cynthia Schmulewski. We have a very eminent expert with us today, Dr. Roger Tideman. Welcome to the show, Dr. Tideman. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Priya. It's wonderful to be here, and thank you, Gary, and the panel.
Before I hand over to Gary to introduce the expert and begin with the show, I would like to mention to the audience that if you have a question for Dr. Tideman, you can send in your questions to me via email at priya@trialx.com, or you can press 1 on your keypad and we will bring you on air to ask your question. Gary will now introduce us to our expert and begin with the discussion. Gary, you're on air.
Priya, thank you so much, and as always, thanks for providing the myeloma group here this particular forum. And before I introduce our featured speaker, I just want to take the opportunity to let my fellow panel members know how very honored I am to just be included with this renowned group. They are all patient advocates living with multiple myeloma and spending their valuable time and energy in support of the myeloma patient community, and I'm just so happy to be a member. Dr. Tideman, is that correct?
Yes, Tideman, that's correct.
Tideman, okay. Dr. Tideman is a scientist at the Ontario Cancer Institute and a hematologist specializing in multiple myeloma and lymphoma within the Division of Medical Oncology and Hematology at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center, and is an associate professor of medicine at the University of Toronto, with appointments from the Department of Medical Biophysics and in the Department of Medicine. Dr. Tideman is trained in New Zealand as a hematologist and a fellow of both the Royal Australasia College of Physicians and the Royal College of Pathologists of Australasia. Also, he was appointed in 2008 as a staff hematologist at Mayo Clinic from 2009 to 2010, and he was an assistant professor of medicine at Mayo Clinic's College of Medicine in 2000 as well. So thank you, Doctor, for all you've done for the myeloma patient community, and we welcome you to the CURE panel.
Thank you very much, Gary. Thank you.
Dr. Tideman, you have done a lot of research and on the causes of myeloma relapse. Could you just give us a little synopsis of this work?
Sure. Well, for the treatment of myeloma, we have a number of excellent drugs, but there are some issues with treating multiple myeloma, and the first of these is that even though we can often treat patients to a deep response, many times when we stop treatment, we find that treatment was not a cure and that the patient will relapse. And secondly, when we treat patients, sometimes we find that even with indefinite treatment, a patient's multiple myeloma eventually learns how to escape the drugs that we're using and to progress even whilst the patient is on treatment. And so we wanted to try and understand these phenomena better, and particularly the failure to cure myeloma. And so we went looking for cells that exist in myeloma tumors at the very outset of the disease and that may escape treatment and therefore enable relapse. And we were able to identify a small portion of myeloma tumors that we termed as progenitors that lacked a particular protein called XBP1S, and that we believe that these progenitor cells are less sensitive to drugs like the proteasome inhibitors, and that therefore, yeah, even from day one when we treat patients at diagnosis with these drugs, it seems that we aren't quite able to cure their myeloma because of the existence of these cells. And so we've also been doing some work looking at myeloma progression on treatment, and I think that in many patients that's due to a different phenomenon, and we're trying to track down the cause for that at present. Keith Stewart and others have done some excellent work looking at resistance to the IMiD class of drugs, that's thalidomide, Revlimid, and pomalidomide, and have related resistance to loss of cereblon or proteins that act in the cereblon pathway. And so I think we're now beginning to understand better the causes of drug resistance in myeloma, and I think that will allow us to move forward in developing new treatments that can overcome these problems.
Okay. In this relapse setting, you know, once it's occurred, you say there's these progenitor cells. Are they also considered precursor cells, or did I read that wrong? Are they progenitor cells?
I think in lay terms they're precursor cells, but the medical terminology is progenitor cell.
Oh, okay. In the myeloma relapse setting, what do you feel are the best treatments for the long-term disease control after relapse? If you have this, you know, this resistance, is there a combination that you've used that you find successful?
Sure. I mean, this is a very complex and difficult question, and it really depends on what first-line treatment you've had and what response you had to that, and whether there were any toxicities, and whether or not you're eligible for high-dose therapy and a transplant, or perhaps a second transplant. And all of these factors usually play into the decision as to what treatment to recommend at relapse. But in general, following relapse, most clinicians are thinking about treating patients with indefinite treatment. That is, the patient remains on treatment as long as they continue to respond to it. If there's an option for transplant, this is usually the time that it would be done, either a first or second transplant rather than later on. And if patients have previously had a proteasome inhibitor-based regimen, then clinicians will often swap them over to an IMiD-based regimen like Revlimid or pomalidomide, or vice versa. If they've had an IMiD up front, then at relapse they'll often go on to a proteasome inhibitor-based treatment at relapse.
And in Canada, do you generally use, you know, one or the other? Like I know that the two that seem to be most used, actually three probably, is you know, RD, and then Cyborg D, and then RVD. Those three seem to be the you know, are they
right,
the same to be used in Canada as well?
Yeah, similar, but there are sort of funding restraints here that differ from the U.S., and I think for transplant-eligible patients in Canada, most of our patients would receive Cyborg-D induction, that's Velcade, cyclophosphamide, and dexamethasone, followed by their transplant, whereas transplant-ineligible patients would in general receive VMP induction, although I think there are moves afoot to get Revlimid also funded as frontline treatment in that patient cohort.
Okay. So in this work with progenitor cells, what are they really, and how do these differ from stem cells, and where do they come from? Are they just there?
Right, so progenitor cells is just a fancy name for immature cells, really. And these cells have some ability to self-renew themselves, and they have some ability to turn into mature into, if you like, more adult type of cells. But unlike stem cells, they're already somewhat committed towards a specific type, becoming a specific type of cell or tissue. So whereas a stem cell can often become a lot of different types of things, a progenitor is somewhat committed already to becoming something. And in our work, we examined myeloma cells that were committed to becoming plasma cells but were not yet plasma cells. So we called these progenitor cells. And I think in doing so, we avoided the difficult term stem cells, because stem cells has a lot of connotations in terms of what the cell can do, and in cancer would imply that this one cell could reinitiate a tumor, and we hadn't demonstrated that for the cells that we were studying, so we resorted to the more generic term progenitor cells. And the progenitor cells in myeloma
cells
is...
Do they just exist, or do they come from stem cells?
So progenitor cells are in between stem cells and mature cells. So, but in myeloma, and in a lot of cancers, stem cells have not been adequately defined. We would like to be able to get to the point where we can take a single cell and say, this is a stem cell, and if we put this one cell into a mouse or a person or a test tube, it will create a myeloma tumor. And in myeloma, we're not quite there yet.
Okay. One other question before we get into the questions from the panel is, does this then confirm the philosophy of extended treatment in maintenance, that these progenitor cells just keep kind of hanging out there, turning into myeloma cells, and as a result, you got to keep after them for an extended period of time, so they do, as they pop up, you kill them?
Yeah, I think that's a great example of an argument that could be used to support extended treatment. So, of course, the extended treatment is important first in killing all of the plasma cells, which we know are an important part of the tumor, and they self-renew, we think, and, you can probably have myeloma just with those guys and nothing else. But I think patients also have progenitor cells, and so when you wipe out the plasma cells, it seems likely that these progenitor cells, which may otherwise have been lying dormant, can now mature into becoming plasma cells. And perhaps by using continuous or extended treatment, you can keep suppressing or killing those myeloma plasma cells as they develop, and in doing so exhaust the progenitor cell population.
So once they're gone, are they gone? Is that your thinking? Meaning that if you keep after them, you might be able to, there'll be none left.
We don't have any evidence, I think, at this point that sort of indefinite treatment or continuous treatment is increasing the cure rate. So I think it would be purely speculative. But my hope is that that by identifying these progenitor cells that may be escaping treatment with our current therapies, one day we may be able to aim for a cure by targeting both the progenitors and the plasma cells at the same time and sort of have a short, sharp treatment that hits all of those cell populations and eradicates them, and that could potentially lead to a cure.
Kind of kill the root, kill the cancer?
Yeah, at the same time. That's right.
Okay. All right. I'll tell you that the group has been very, very interested in asking their questions of you. And I know Nick Van Dyke is biting at the bit to ask this question. So, Nick, are you there?
I am.
All right. Fire away.
Thanks for joining us, Doctor, and thanks for that explanation. I guess this is a somewhat related question, and it's in a couple of parts, but I'll try and get through it quickly. So if the progenitor cells lack the protein to start to make the proteasome inhibitors work, is that lacking from the start, or is that developed over time, and is that the same issue with immunomodulatory drugs? And then that obviously begs the question, what classes of drugs are capable of impacting the progenitor cells? Would it be alkylators like melphalan, or anthracyclines like adriamycin, or nothing that we know of can reach them?
Great question, Nick, and thanks for asking it. So the progenitors that we've described lack this protein called XBP1S, and that protein is important for switching on the cell's production of immunoglobulin, which is the stuff that we measure as an M spike in the protein or urine of myeloma patients. And we think that the myeloma cell's production of this immunoglobulin at high levels is really what makes them susceptible to drugs like Velcade, the proteasome inhibitors. And so the progenitors that lack this XBP1S and that don't make this protein seem relatively resistant to proteasome inhibitors. And of course, if you went high enough in the concentration of proteasome inhibitors, you'd be able to kill these cells, but you'd also be hitting all the normal cells in the body as well. So I think these cells just simply don't have a therapeutic window to respond to drugs like Velcade.
Mm-hmm.
But the progenitor cells may well respond to other types of treatment, of course. And, you know, I do believe that alkylators may be one class of drug that they respond to, and that this may be the reason why high-dose melphalan and an autologous stem cell transplant is so successful in myeloma. And perhaps this is why that's the only treatment that we can use in myeloma that gives our patients a decent treatment-free interval. So that single treatment alone, you know, that takes 2 weeks in hospital, or you may have it as an outpatient, can produce, you know, a treatment-free interval for patients that may be 2 years or longer, quite a bit longer in some patients. And most of our other treatments don't do that. So I think that, you know, alkylators may be one class of drug that are perhaps hitting the progenitors and sort of biting deeper into the tumor providing sort of a deeper, in that way, a deeper response and a longer remission. Drugs like anthracyclines, I honestly don't know, and I don't know that anyone knows if they are hitting progenitors or simply the plasma cells. These are used in B-cell malignancies, so it's possible that they may be hitting the earlier stages as well. The immunomodulatory drugs such as Revlimid and pomalidomide, I think it's an open question whether or not they hit cells beyond the plasma cells, the progenitors. But I think there's a lot of suggestion from the literature that they might be causing maturation arrest of earlier cells. So I think that these types of drugs may be killing plasma cells, and I'd speculate that they would be just causing arrest of the progenitor cells, trying to, in effect, preventing them from maturing.
Sorry, one very quick follow-up, Ben.
Sure.
The progenitor cells, are they what cook up the chromosomal or cytogenetic changes, like a deletion 13, that might make the disease less responsive to melphalan, either out of the gate or in response to treatment if it's refractory? Or is that something that happens at a later stage in the maturation of the cell?
That's a great question, and in fact, that's part of what we're studying right at the moment. So we're trying to understand where those secondary events, genetic events within the myeloma clone occur. You know, do they occur just in the plasma cells, or do they occur in earlier cells such as the progenitor cells? We're really trying to understand exactly how malignant the progenitor cells are. Are they fully malignant, or do they need extra sort of genetic hits to redevelop the disease? And so that's an unanswered question, but we're working on it, and I'm sure other people are working on it as well.
Got it. Thank you. I'll turn myself back to mute and let other folks ask questions.
Great.
Thanks, Nick. Jack, you there?
I am here.
Your
Nick's
question.
Follow-up question was exactly what I was going to ask after having listened and learned an awful lot, and that is what kind of causes the whole, we hear of myeloma clones, and is it the myeloma cell that's cloning itself with variations, or is it these progenitor cells? But I think you answered it in terms of that's being researched at this time.
Correct.
So I want to ask more broad questions. These days we have IMIDs, we have proteasome inhibitors. If you ask a group of myeloma experts, doctors, they'll say the next most promising treatment are these monoclonal antibodies that we're hearing so much about.
Right.
Can you look one treatment beyond that and tell us what you think the most promising area of available treatment is for a relapsed refractory patient and newly diagnosed patients over the next 1 to 2 years?
Sure. Well, I think the monoclonal antibodies are certainly very exciting, particularly the anti-CD38 antibodies have shown already a lot of promise in early phase clinical trials, drugs like daratumumab. And I think these drugs are particularly exciting because they get around some of the conventional resistance mechanisms that may exist in myeloma cells, in that they don't require the cell to have all the genes which it would normally have to undergo suicide, for example. That's how some tumor cells die in response to drug, and how some cells become resistant as they lose those genes. And the monoclonal antibodies really work in a very different way. They just attach to the outside of the cell, and they can either deliver a drug inside the cell, or they can help the immune system target the cell. And that overcomes some of the conventional drug resistance mechanisms that we see in myeloma. And I certainly think that some of the later progenitor stages, and perhaps the most important stages for replenishing the tumor, are CD38 positive. So, I think those drugs look very promising and are likely to be increasingly used in combination with other chemotherapy drugs, presumably initially in relapse patients, but ultimately, I think they will move forward into the front line and probably be used in combination with our standard 3 or 4 drug combinations that we're using at the moment. Beyond the monoclonal antibodies, there are a broad spectrum of other types of drugs being developed. One of these that I've used is KPT-330. It's a new class of drug that inhibits a nuclear export protein called XPO1. And so this is getting away from the proteasome inhibitors or the IMIDs or the alkylating agents. It's a new class of drug. And I think one of my patients is one of the first patients to go into complete response on single-agent treatment. And she was she's been resistant to everything else leading up to this trial. So, I'm excited about that drug. I'm not exactly sure what the response rate will be overall amongst myeloma patients, but certainly there are some patients that will respond to that particular agent.
Would you mind repeating that agent name and who the manufacturer is?
It's Carrier Pharm is the manufacturer, and the drug itself has just got
number.
It's called KPT-330.
Thank you.
And then there are other classes of agents such as the bromodomain inhibitors. These work by hitting proteins that we think are important in driving the cancer cell to proliferate. And I think from a theoretical perspective, they have a lot of promise. And they're just going through early phase studies as we speak. So it'll be interesting to see how they develop in terms of their clinical efficacy. And then there are, other drugs like the AKT inhibitors, the MEK inhibitors, the IGF-1 receptor inhibitors that may help, and the histone deacetylase inhibitors that may help overcome drug resistance mechanisms, particularly to the proteasome inhibitors.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you, Jack. Our next panelist is Pat, and Pat has some recent experience with relapse and has got some questions, or a question for you about that, Doctor. Pat, are you there?
I'm here, Gary. Thanks.
You bet. Your question?
Hi, Pat.
Doctor, are you doing any clinical work right now, or is it all research?
Yeah, no, I've got 2 clinics a week, so I'm seeing myeloma patients.
I was going to say, you have a pretty broad understanding and background of the therapy, so I got the feeling you weren't just sitting in a lab.
No.
Well, my question has to do with, I guess there's 2. The first one's pretty simple, and how long you think it might take for research like you're doing to actually trickle down to where it's helping patients. So I guess that's my first question.
Okay. So it's very difficult to come up with an answer to that. So I think that the XBP1S negative cells that we described that are escaping proteasome inhibitor treatment, you know, other people can now go looking for those, and eradication of those cells can be used as, you know, a secondary endpoint in clinical studies. And so moving forward, I would hope that using either our approach or other broad minimal residual disease detection strategies, that we can now start trying to define treatments that can target those populations to provide deeper responses and more durable responses for patients. But when we will find those treatments is unknown. At the moment in Canada, we're doing a clinical trial with busulfan and melphalan as a conditioning agent, and as part of that trial, we are looking at these progenitor cells to see if the busulfan adds anything to the melphalan in terms of the depth of response that we achieve.
Great answer. Thank you. I guess my original question was going to be something along the lines about, as a patient, and I I'm experiencing a third relapse right now. You must have to be pretty creative there in Canada. You don't have quite the access to quite as many drug options, I believe, as we do here in the States. But I'm having trouble getting my specialists to think outside the box and look at tweaking therapy and maybe adding a little of this here, a little of that there. They seem to get pretty focused, and it seems to be pretty basic. Can you any tips? You must be creative. So if you've got somebody who's now in Canada now, pomalidomide and Kyprolis are not approved yet in Canada, are they?
Yes, pomalidomide is approved. Kyprolis is coming through the pipeline, I think. So things aren't quite as bad in Canada, but we do certainly have some limitations and some restrictions on how we practice based on what the government or the province will fund. So I think in terms of convincing, I'm sorry to hear about the third relapse, by the way, that's difficult. But in terms of getting your doctor to think outside the box, I think most doctors like me would be swayed mostly by clinical trial evidence rather than perhaps theories from studies in test tubes, if you like, or and certainly would be more swayed by clinical trial evidence than anecdotes that one patient did better with this treatment versus another treatment. And so most of the clinical trial evidence that we have supports, you know, the use of three drugs in combination, or sometimes two, sometimes four, but often three. And I think your doctor is probably, you know, working with the data that we have to support either the use of, you know, RVD or pomalidomide, cyclophosphamide, dex, or some other combination like that. And it's hard for a doctor to step out the box and start experimenting because that's not really allowed. You know, I think certainly, you know, there is evidence for using things like Biaxin and adding that to the mix, and that can be useful in some patients. And, you know, there's emerging evidence for the use of bendamustine and Doxil, but these things have limited benefit, and I think exactly how they fit into the overall strategy is still poorly defined.
Of course. So if you get to the end of what's readily available for you, and I certainly wasn't dumping on our dear friends from the north there.
Yeah.
My understanding is that doctors in the United States there's more flexibility with what you can do off label and that kind of thing.
There may be. We certainly have limitations with funding, and, you know, we often only get to use a drug once, for example, in Ontario, and retreatment becomes an issue for us. So, we have to be a little bit creative in terms of how we manage people because of those limitations.
Sure. Well, I just think it's wonderful that you're both a researcher and a clinician, because that has to help give you some insight, and you understand who you're fighting for, and I really appreciate all the hard work and creativity that you're bringing to this. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And this is all about the patients. And I think, you know, by having a clinic, that really does bring me back to the ground every week when I go to clinic and see people with myeloma. So thank you.
Thanks, Doc. Thank you, Gary.
Hey, thanks, Pat. Cindy, are you there?
I'm here, Sally. Can you hear me?
All right. I'm sorry, Cindy. I said you'd be first last time, and I'll make sure that I get with Priya and make it happen for you next time.
No problem.
Your questions, please.
Okay. Thanks, Doctor, for all the explanations you've given me. I'm kind of fascinated by these progenitor cells. This is basically the first time I've really heard about them. And from my understanding, these progenitor cells are the cells that eventually develop into the myeloma plasma cells. Now, what I was wondering, is there a test that measures just the progenitor cells? Like when you get your M-spike measured, that's your plasma cells. What type of testing will allow you to find out if you have any of these myeloma progenitor cells left in your blood?
Yeah. Well, firstly, is it Cindy or is Cynthia?
Either one.
Okay. Hi, Cindy. First off, they probably reside in the bone marrow rather than the blood. Secondly, there is really no clinical tests that we use to measure progenitor cells at the moment. You know, we're looking at them in a research context rather than for managing patients. But having said that, multicolor flow cytometry and minimal residual disease testing that's based on PCR or DNA sequencing, all of these techniques will tend to pick up some or all of the progenitor cells.
So that new flow cytometry test that I'm hearing a lot about that's coming to a clinic now would be able, with your minimal residual disease, that they'll be able to tell if your disease is in plasma cells or progenitor cells. Is that what you're saying? Or
I think that the multicolor flow cytometry minimal residual disease testing will pick up the plasma cells, of course, and then often that will also be able to pick up CD138 negative progenitor cells, particularly if these are 38 positive. So there's an earlier subset, we believe, of progenitor cells that feed into the plasma cell population, and I think depending on how the flow cytometry is analyzed, that population is probably also detectable. We do think that there may be earlier progenitor cells that wouldn't be detected by multicolor flow cytometry, but I think it's controversial. And, you know, the relevance of testing for those cells is unclear at the present time. You know, an important thing to think about is that the progenitor cells have the ability to, we believe, to turn into plasma cells, and so if they're relevant to the disease process, then they can do that probably within the space of days or 1 or 2 weeks. If they're relevant to the disease process, then just testing for the minimal residual plasma cells a couple of weeks after treatment is probably enough to tell whether there's any minimal residual progenitor cells that are contributing to the plasma cell compartment. So at the moment, it's a research tool more than a clinical test to evaluate for progenitor cells.
Okay, but that multicolor flow cytometry test, that is starting to be available clinically now. Is that correct?
Yes, there's a lot of centers that are starting to use that. And I think the value of the test is primarily prognostic at the moment. We know there's some very nice publications from the Spanish group, Dr. San Miguel and others, that show that if you have no minimal residual disease following your induction treatment, first-line treatment, that, you know, the rates of progression are much lower than if you've got residual disease. And similarly, Bart Barlogi from Arkansas has shown similar findings that, you know, the median time to progression for patients who have achieved complete remission and a sustained complete remission is much longer than for patients who have residual disease. And so from a prognostic perspective, it seems to be quite valuable. From a treatment perspective, it's unclear yet, you know, whether or not we need to treat patients differently based on that, based on a minimal residual disease result, because ultimately for all patients we've only got the same drugs available, and should we be adjusting our treatment based on minimal residual disease test findings? We don't know.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And your work with these progenitor cells, most of that is work that you're doing in the research lab. It's not in clinical trials yet. Is that correct?
That's largely correct. We have a number of patients at our facility who have donated bone marrow samples, and we're sort of looking at their progenitor cells. And we do get bone marrow samples from one Canadian clinical trial of busulfan and melphalan for transplant, in which we're looking at progenitor cells, you know, at diagnosis and following first-line treatment and following their transplant. So we're trying to extend our findings into the clinical trial setting, but I think there's still a lot to be learnt. And as I said earlier, there's still a lot of controversy about the role of these cells and exactly how best to define them. So.
Okay, thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you, Cindy. Well, we have another panelist who is new to the group. John, are you there?
Yes. Thanks, Gary. Thanks to the panel and Priya for the opportunity, and thank you, Dr. Tiedemann, for participating. Really appreciate this opportunity and your information and your help.
Hi, John.
Hi. As far as the clinical trials you mentioned, can you ask patients, is there a website that would inform U.S. patients if they would be eligible for clinical trials through your institution or others in Canada?
Sure. So, of course, with any out-of-country patients, just as with any country, there may be sort of issues with funding, a change in, you know, care to a different country. But we have our clinical trials posted on the Princess Margaret website. Actually, the address to get to the clinical trials is quite a long one and complicated. But basically, if you go to www.theprincessmargaret.ca and do a search for clinical trials, you'll eventually work your way to the point where you can look up clinical trials specifically for multiple myeloma that are running at our institution. And then the Health Canada website, which also has quite a complicated name that's too long to remember, also has some information on multiple myeloma trials that are running in Canada.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that. And as far as institutions or organizations that support your research or research similar to yours, I know you mentioned Dr. Keith Stewart and his work at the Mayo in Arizona. Are there any major multiple myeloma organizations like MMRF or LLS or IMF or large pharma companies that are partnering with you and you're partnering with these other organizations to leverage and accelerate your research?
Right. Well, in Canada, I've been receiving some very useful support from the CIHR, which is the Canadian Institute of Health Research, and from the Canadian Cancer Society, and also from patient donations and our Princess Margaret Foundation. When I was in the U.S., I actually had a fellowship with the MMRF, and I'm sure that those institutions are you know, working on the same problems that we are. You know, I talk closely with colleagues in the States, particularly at Mayo Clinic and TGen and elsewhere, as we try and sort of move forward together and trying to understand drug resistance and what contributes to that. You know, it's not all just progenitors, although that factors into it. There's also the issue of clonal tiding and you know, secondary mutations in myeloma cells that can lead to drug resistance. So there is a network, I think, of researchers that are addressing these problems and supported in one way or another by these institutions and by pharma. In Canada, we have the Myeloma Research Network, which I belong to, and you know, we get together regularly, either in person or by teleconference, to discuss these issues and clinical trials that we're developing based on the work that we and others are doing in the lab.
Okay, that's great. And I know that the MMRF has tried to do a lot, and I think there's this other cancer organization that Katie Kirk is part of to help researchers and clinical doctors collaborate as opposed to silo their ideas and
right.
research to make more effective gains in shorter periods of time.
Right.
So that's here. Thank you for that. And finally, you touched on MRD, minimal residual disease, and you touched on Arkansas, and let's see here, Dr. San Miguel, who I presume is in Europe, are you aware of institutions in the U.S. that are allowing patients to have MRD tests at this point?
Sure, yeah. Actually, I recently saw a paper that reviewed MRD practices at some U.S. institutions and looked at how they were doing this by flow cytometry. Unfortunately, I don't remember the names of the institutions that the study was on. I'm not sure it mentioned them. It just gave sort of figures and details as to how each institution was operating. And it seems as if there's not a very standardized MRD approach occurring in the U.S. In Europe, I think the flow cytometry has been a little bit more standardized, leading out of the work from the Spanish sort of define clonal plasma cells and minimal residual disease by their multiflow cytometry approach. And in the U.S. there's been a tendency to take that work and each institution apply it in a slightly different way. And so, you know, one of the thrusts of this excellent paper was that there should be more standardization applied in the U.S. Having said that, I think there's many centers that don't do MRD testing, and partly that is because, although MRD testing appears to have prognostic value, it's difficult to know yet how this fits into adjusting treatment for patients, and whether or not we should adjust treatment based on MRD results and whether that would improve outcomes or not. We don't really have that information yet, and so many centers are not yet doing this.
I see.
I can tell you that it is being done at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. This is Gary Peterson. I've had an MRD test there, as has Nick Van Dyke. So
right.
You know it's there, and I think it's done at Mayo as well, but not as a standard practice.
Right, I'm sure it is being done at the major centers. I think the review of MRD practices covered about 12 different centers in the U.S. So the larger centers are doing it for sure.
Very good. Thank you.
Good.
I appreciate that. Thanks for your answers to my questions and all
sure.
your other help.
Sure.
And
you're
thank you, John, for your contribution. Right now we just have pretty much used up all our time for the panel. and was wondering, Priya, if you could start bringing some of the callers online or some of the questions from the callers.
Thank you, Gary. We have Dana calling in. Dana, you're on air. Please ask your question.
Yes, thank you, Priya. Good afternoon, Dr. Tiedemann. My name is Dana Holmes. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for taking the call. I'm a smoldering multiple.
Dana.
Thank
Hi,
you.
Dana.
Hi, Gary. Yes.
Thank you.
Dr. Tiedemann, I have a question from a smoldering standpoint. I understand you're currently looking if the progenitor cells start out malignant or if they develop their malignant signatures. So I'm wondering, are they actually present at the smoldering stage, and are there likely less of them? Therefore, perhaps would they be sensitive to treatment at an earlier disease state?
So we haven't looked at smoldering myeloma, but because plasma cells develop from B cells and the progenitors that we've described exist in between that transition between B cells and plasma cells, and because we think that some of the genetic hits that occur in myeloma occur in the B cells, and yet the disease is caused by the plasma cells, it's likely that there are progenitors at every stage of the disease, but it's not clear to what extent these have the same malignant potential as the plasma cells. To become cancerous, a cell has to usually acquire multiple different genetic hits or events, and it's possible that the progenitors are lacking one of those hits, or it's possible that they have all of them and they're ready to step in the shoes of the plasma cells as soon as those are blasted away by drugs like Velcade and other drugs. So we're still trying to work to define exactly their role, and I think it's likely that they're there in smoldering myeloma, but I'm not sure that it would alter the way that we manage smoldering myeloma at present.
Thank you. Are you doing any work, or do you plan to do any work with smoldering myeloma patients, any clinical trials to perhaps delay progression or even prevent it?
Right. Well, I think everyone is looking very with great interest and excitement at the results of the Spanish group that have used Revlimid and dexamethasone in smoldering myeloma. And there are other studies also in the U.S. coming out now looking at the treatment of smoldering myeloma, for example, with proteasome inhibitors and other agents. We don't currently have a smoldering myeloma clinical trial at our center, but I think for high-risk patients, it would be something that we're interested in pursuing for sure.
Okay, thank you. And lastly, do we collect these progenitor cells during stem cell harvest?
That's a great question. We don't know. I've got someone that's interested in looking at that. The data from previous studies of stem cell harvest and stem cell collection have showed that if you get rid of the myeloma plasma cells from the stem cell bags, the collection, by purging those collections for the plasma cells, you don't change the outcome of transplant, but it's something that perhaps we should readdress now that we know about progenitor cells. But my feeling is most likely the residual disease is still existing in the patient after the melphalan or after the high-dose chemotherapy, and so it's not clear whether or not there would be any benefit in trying to purge the stem cell units for progenitors or whether we even collect them in the first place. Because there has been a fairly good study looking for progenitors in the blood through sequencing, and it didn't find any evidence of progenitors in the blood, so they're not routinely there.
Okay. Well, thank you so very much for your time. Very much appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you, Dana. Dr. Tiedemann, we have received some questions via email. I'll just quickly go over them. One of our listeners asks, do we have a test to identify the percentage of progenitor cells that remain following therapy? She goes on to ask, should we identify what percentage of progenitor cells there are before starting therapy? Because if we have a high progenitor cell population, then perhaps using a proteasome inhibitor is not the best choice.
So the way that we've identified progenitor cells, we use a system called it's a flow cytometry based cell sorting system, and then we go on and look at it, individual cells by immunofluorescence and FISH. And so it's a very complicated process, and it's not generally available as a clinical test. I think, you know, the presence of progenitor cells would be detected by, to some extent, by ultracolor flow, and sequencing minimal residual disease tests will pick these up after the disease is gone, but it would be very difficult to distinguish between what was a progenitor and what was a myeloma cell. The bottom line for patients is that it's not something that we should be testing for as yet. It certainly isn't something that would preclude us using a proteasome inhibitor because, you know, these are some of the most effective drugs that we have for myeloma, and even though they're not curative, they do certainly, you know, treat the vast majority of the tumor cells and get rid of those, and, you know, that can produce very useful remissions. So there's nothing to suggest that we should be avoiding proteasome inhibitor treatment based on the presence of progenitor cells.
She has a couple of more questions. She asks, should we know that when people do not relapse, that the therapy regimen did kill the progenitor cells as well? Do melphalan and alkylators hit that cell population that accounts for survival rates? And should alkylators be combined with proteasomes to ensure you hit progenitor populations like the cyborgs?
Yeah, these are great questions, and, you know, undoubtedly I think we are curing some myeloma patients, albeit a lot fewer than we would like. And that in those patients, you know, we have effectively eradicated all of the tumor cells. And if you look at the studies from the Spanish and from Dr. Biologi from University of Arkansas, and you look at patients that achieve a complete remission and with no minimal residual disease and who sustain that over long periods, the progression-free survival of those patients is extremely long. It takes many years for the average patient for myeloma to come back in those patients. And in fact, in some patients whose myeloma remains in complete remission, you know, after 10 or 11 years, it's likely that they, a proportion of those patients are going to be cured. Further follow-up for another 5 or 6 years after 17 years, in fact, has shown that a large chunk of those patients don't relapse. And so what drugs achieve that, I'm not sure, but I think, as I said earlier, that alkylating agents may be one of the class of drug that contributes to hitting the progenitor cell population, and of course just using these agents at high dose as we do with transplant allows us to hit the small number of cells that are resistant to the standard dose of those drugs. So I think those drugs do contribute to long treatment-free intervals for patients and probably do improve survival and may contribute to those rare cases where we see cure.
Thank you, Dr. Tiedemann. Gary, I think we have time for another panel round. If any other panelists want to ask a question, please go ahead.
Nick, you must have one.
I was actually, everything that I was going to ask has been answered, so.
Okay. Jack, how about yourself?
I've never heard Nick speechless.
Very good.
I'm with Nick.
You caught me multitasking. I was taking notes furiously, so.
Okay. All right.
I'm with Nick. I've had a lot to absorb, and I'm sure I'll have questions the minute we hang up.
Okay. Cindy?
Oh, well, I guess I'm going back to my question about minimal residual disease and the fact that there's a group of people that never achieve that complete response is, and I know that they're saying maybe there's like an 8% of the population that revert back to MGUS type state. Mm-hmm. Now, would that include progenitor cells? Or I'm trying to put this all together. I'm trying to make sense of what I heard tonight.
Yeah, I think if we think about the tumor, there's an extremely complex interplay of several different processes going on. So one of the processes is that there's subclonal variety when it's a tumor, meaning that although the cells are all derived from a single cell, you know, as the daughter cells proliferate, they branch out and diverge from one another with new genetic events. And part of the clone is probably still, you know, in an MGUS-like state and never acquired those extra events, whereas other parts of the clone have gone on to develop the secondary mutations that led to myeloma. So that's one process that's going on. There's the subclonal variety and diversity. And then the second process is that as the clone reproduces itself, you know, it exists at multiple different levels, both at plasma cells and at earlier progenitor cells. And it's probable that the subclonal picture is present also at the multiple levels of the tumor, both at plasma cells and at progenitor cells. And so when you think about what's going on with the tumor in response to, you know, with myeloma in response to treatment, you have to think about all of these different all of the different intratumor heterogeneity that's present and what all of the different cells are doing at any one point. And so it certainly is possible to go back probably to a more MGUS-like picture where you just have a stable power protein for a very long time, and it may be that, you know, the more active myeloma cells that have the secondary mutations have been well treated for a period, and what's left behind are the more the less malignant cells, which may have redeveloped from a progenitor stage into the primary plasma cell population for a period in that patient. So it's a great question, and there's a lot going on when we think about the dynamics inside the multiple myeloma.
Pat Killingsworth, I jumped over you. I'm sorry. Did you have a question?
No, Doctor, you've talked several times about the importance of being able to come at myeloma from several different directions,
mm-hmm.
and researchers, you know, the great hope right now is immunotherapy, but it just seems to me like the immunotherapy angle, like that, will enhance the therapies that we have now or the therapies that we come up with, but it really isn't hitting it from a totally different direction. And it sounds to me like your research may in fact do that. Do I have a correct interpretation of that?
I don't want to oversell what we're doing. I think there's certainly some great work that's going on with the immunotherapy. And, you know, we have a long way to go to work out how important the progenitors are to relapse and disease sustenance and whether or not we can treat these things. I think the immunotherapy's angle is very interesting with the PD-1 antibodies and just with the monoclonal antibodies. I'm very excited about that, and I think they may, you know, have real impact for patients in the near future, particularly, you know, the anti-CD38 antibodies such as daratumumab. I'm very excited to see what happens there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And John, did you have a question, another question? John, are you still online?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can.
Oh, good deal. Yes, I am still here. We talked about monoclonal antibodies as one type of immune therapy. There's another immune therapy, gene therapy, University of Pennsylvania, a doctor in Baltimore is working on this too. Do you see that, again, as another angle that could be leveraged to fight myeloma?
For sure, yeah. I think it's a little bit further away from prime time, but I think it's a promising angle. You know, ramping up the immune system to attack the tumor cells has been a promise of immunotherapy for a lot of different cancers, and it's starting to pay dividends in some diseases. I think it's a little bit further away from multiple myeloma yet, but you know, we have these monoclonal antibodies, particularly a PD-1 antibody that may suppress the T suppressor cells to help stimulate immune response against myeloma. We have, you know, the viral strategy, oncolytic viruses trying to infect myeloma cells. So there's a lot of things that sort of are there on the horizon and getting closer, but perhaps a little bit further away still than the anti-CD38 antibodies.
Sure. Thank you.
Sure.
Dr. Tiedemann, you have done a remarkable job of going through all of our questions and all of our listener questions, and we've come pretty close to the end, unless Priya has a question or two she might want to interject at this point.
Thank you, Gary. Then you almost are up for us. Dr. Tiedemann, thank you so very much for joining us today. And I thank our wonderful myeloma panel, Gary, Pat, Jack, Nick, Cindy, and John. You guys have done an awesome job. Thank you so very much for being with us. Please visit purepanel.carefeed.net for details of upcoming shows, and you can always mail me, priya@trilex.com. The link for today's show will be shared with all participants. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much for having me.